Okay, we'll get started. My name is Peter. I'm an alcoholic. And are we working here? Is this on? Yes. Welcome everyone back. And before we get going, is this on? Good. Before we get going, if we could just take a moment to thank Inar and the rest of the committee for this really great weekend and all the work they've been doing this weekend. I had to wake you up somehow. Big Book says great events will come to pass for me and countless others if my relationship with God is right, and I like to consider this a great event in my life and part of doing this deal and carrying a message. And, so I thank all of you for being there, and I notice we have a whole lot more this afternoon than we did this morning. So thanks for being here. We last left off on page 52, and up until this point, we'd gone through doctor's opinion, and we talked about the physical allergy to alcohol in step one, the mental obsession to alcohol in step one, and the spiritual malady that's part of this threefold illness. And in chapter two, agnostics, we're moving into step two, and we're going to find out, as we said, how, where, and why we ought to find this higher power. On page 53, we'll pick up here, in the middle of the page, first full paragraph, it says, when we became alcoholics crushed by a self-imposed crisis, no one did this to me. By a self-imposed crisis, we cannot postpone or evade. We had to fearlessly face the proposition that God is everything or else he is nothing. God either is or he isn't. What was our choice to be? And lots of times when we're first coming around and a sponsor asks us that question, we always want to give the right answer. We say, well, yeah, God's everything, until it gets a little bit tight in certain areas and then we're not so sure if God is everything. One of the questions I had to consider with my current sponsor was this. Going through this work, going through this part of step two, when I said God was everything, how did that look when I hit step 10 and entered the world of the Spirit? How much more growing and understanding and effectiveness that I had with this power? Was God really everything or nothing? Or was he everything when it was convenient for me? When things were going good, it's easy to say God's everything. When the back's against the wall, is God still everything? So one of the things you can sit with as you go through this work, what does it look like now hitting step two when we say God is everything? And what does that look like by the time we're cleaning up amends in step 10 and doing the disciplines with 11? It says, arrived at this point, we were squarely confronted with the question of faith. We cannot duck the issue. Some of us had already walked over the bridge of reason toward the desire shore of faith. The outlines and a promise in new land have brought luster to tired eyes and fresh courage to flagging spirits. And for me, that showed up in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous when I saw people here doing the deal, living free from alcoholism. We talked about why we ought to find this higher power and how. Our book is now going to tell us where. And if we flip over to page 55. Second paragraph. And this is where. Actually, we were fooling ourselves, but deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental or the basic idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things. Things get in the way. We worship other things rather than this power. The great thing about house cleaning is that stuff is removed. But in some form or other, it is there. For faith in a power greater than ourselves and miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. We finally saw that faith in some kind of God was part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we had for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was much a fact as we were. We found the great reality, or God, deep down within us. In the last analysis, it is only there that God may be found. It was so with us. It says we can only clear the ground a bit. If our testimony helps sweep away prejudice, enables you to think honestly, encourages you to search diligently within yourself, if you wish, you can join us on the broad highway. With this attitude, and here's a great promise, with this attitude, you're not going to fail. The consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you. Another promise. In this book, you will read the experience of a man who thought he was an atheist. The story is so interesting that some that some of it should be told now. His change of heart was dramatic, convincing, and moving. This story is about a gentleman named Fritz Mayo, who is referred to in the doctor's opinion. And one of the stories called Our Southern Friend. It's our friend was a minister's son. He attended church school where he became rebellious at what he thought was an overdose of religious education. For years thereafter, he was dogged by trouble or frustration, business failure, insanity, fatal illness, suicide. These calamities in his immediate family embittered and depressed him. I identify with this guy. Post-war disillusionment, ever more serious alcoholism, impending mental and physical collapse brought him to the point of self-destruction. It says one night when confined in a hospital, he was approached by an alcoholic who had known a spiritual experience. He was approached by someone who had this experience. Earlier we talked about one drunk working with another. Okay. Our friend's gaze rose as he bitterly cried out, "If there is a God, he certainly hasn't done anything for me." But later, alone in his room, he asked this question, "Is it possible that all the religious people I have ever known were wrong?" While pondering the answer, he felt as though he lived in hell. Then, like a thunderbolt, the great thought came. It crowded out all else. "Who are you to say there is no God?" This man recounts that he tumbled out of his bed to his knees. In a few seconds, he was overwhelmed by a conviction of the presence of God. It almost sounds like Bill's experience here. Skip down to the last paragraph on that page. It says, "Thus was our friend's cornerstone fixed in place. No later vicissitude has shaken it. His alcoholic problem was taken away." So he's not hanging in there a day at a time, is he? He's been removed like Step 10 promises tell us. "That very night years ago, it disappeared. Save for a few brief moments of temptation, the thought of a drink has never returned. And at such times, a great revulsion has risen up in him. Seemingly, he could not drink even if he would. God had restored his sanity. Was this but a miracle of healing? Yet its elements are simple. Circumstances made him willing to believe. My experience getting into Alcoholics Anonymous brought me to a place of willing to do anything in order to recover. This gentleman, they write out, circumstances made him willing to believe. Our book says, alcohol was the great persuader that beat us into a state of reasonableness. I am grateful for the bottom I hit. I'll never survive it again. But being on this side of the archway, I'm grateful for the horror I experienced because it has me still hungry to seek now, 15 years later. Even so, God has restored all of us to our right minds. To this man, the revelation was sudden. Some of us grow into it more slowly, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, right? But when God shows up, God shows up. But he has come to all of us who have honestly sought him. When we draw near to him, he's disclosed himself to us. Why would God deny us?
As I begin to see truth, I start to trust that God will show me the way. I'm at a place where, in that first step, we're coming out of the second step now, and we see, a lot of the jargon that goes around Alcoholics Anonymous in the States is that step two is about insanity. I don't know where that came from. Step two for me is a step of hope. Okay? And I needed hope. And the reason I needed hope because I finally found what I was really suffering from, a threefold disease in step one. When I saw the knowledge, the nature, the grave nature of my illness in step one. See, I have an insanity of my body. My body isn't like another person's body. Something happens, this phenomenon of craving, and it says more. And the only thing I can do to not drink is to abstain from it. But I don't have the power to do that because I have this thing called the insanity of my mind. And this mind constantly takes me back. So this insanity that it's going to be different. I'm going to be able to control it. I'm going to be able to enjoy it. It brings me back. And this is on my own power, my own mind, my own thoughts. So now I have an insanity of my body and an insanity of my mind. But then I have an and insanity of my spiritual conditions. I'm restless, I'm irritable, and I'm discontent, and the manifestation of those things show up on page 52. Okay. But we're going to see a promise a little down the line that once that's overcome, the mental and the physical straighten out. But at this point in time, I am in bad shape. It's not acceptable for me to be insane in my body, insane in my mind, and insane in my spiritual nature. I can't walk around the planet like that. But I have no other place to go, and I've been trying for years to get some power and looking for it out there. But then some man shows up and he tells me I can find this power deep down within. Okay. And all I have to say to him, you better be right. You better be right. Because I know I'm done.
Before we move into how it works, some of the things to consider coming out of this chapter is, am I still trying to manage my own life currently? Have I become protective of my ideas and conceptions of God? Where any new ideas or conceptions or work outside of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have contemplative investigation because I'm defining and comprehending God and I box them in. Am I running the show myself? Am I experiencing any fear? Am I living in fear, I ought to say? Because that usually means I'm in self and I'm experiencing some current agnosticism. Am I continuing to grow in understanding and effectiveness? And am I still willing to lay aside prejudice and express a willingness to believe in this power? Have old ideas and attachments still around? Are they still around? Because if they are, they're going to keep me blocked from this power. And what's going to happen is, little by slowly, I will move into that place. The shift of the awakening will stop. I will move into that place where the only solution left for me is to pick up a drink. The thing about alcoholism, it's not going to announce its arrival. It's not going to tell you tomorrow morning around 10, we're going to get drunk, so get ready. It'll just show up and you're gone. Chapter 5, How It Works, page 58. It says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover, people will not completely give themselves to the simple program. So what are we going to fail at? It says, rarely have we seen a person fail at God consciousness, at recovery, who has followed this path. It says, there are such unfortunates, they are not at fault, they seem to have been born that way. They are naturally capable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Our book uses words like manner of living and way of living later on in the book. It's what we do. It isn't the occasional, I'm going to get spiritual on Tuesday afternoon. It's what we do. It says their chances are less than average. There are those two who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. If you empty out this pitcher of water here, it does have the capacity to be filled up again, doesn't it? And that's what we do. We have the capacity to be honest. We have the capacity to be free. We have the capacity to wake up. What has to be done is most of us come in with a full liter of water that's dirty and old. And if we pour into a full glass, what happens? It just overflows. What has to be done with this experience is to be emptied out and put new back. Most of us are so scared to death to empty out, though, that we'll just stay where we are and stay sick. The experience is about subtraction, not addition. We empty out in order to be full. It says, our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, living on self-will and drunk. What happened to us, the spiritual revolution? And what we are like now, living according to God's will for us. If you have decided you want what we have, question I was asked, am I? Am I at a place of willing to go to any lengths? Have I decided to take what you guys got to offer? Well, circumstances made me willing. So I was. And are willing to go to any length to get it. Then you're ready to take certain steps. Skip down to the last sentence. It says, remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful, and as a very wise gentleman told me, also very, very patient. Alcoholism does not care how long we're sober or how many meetings we made, or it doesn't care if I had a spiritual experience 10 years ago and I'm riding off today of an experience 10 years ago. The experience I had 10 years ago may be not sufficient today to keep me recovered. So I need to continue to seek new experiences. Some of us can do that. I found I hit a wall on that. It says, without help, it is too much for us, but there is one, and that's God who has all power. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing, or get us drunk. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon.
I just want to add one thing. It says, but there is one who has all power. If he has all power, what power do we have?
Ego will tell me I have power, though. If not all power, ego will tell me I have power in certain areas. And when I hit a wall, I wonder why. We become a prey to comfortability in Alcoholics Anonymous when, as I shared last night, things start to get comfortable and good, and we start to rest on our laurels, and we start to head for trouble, but ego is going to say everything's okay. You really don't need to go to any lengths anymore. You really don't need to pray and meditate, etc. Page 60. Second paragraph, it says, our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. Step one, we were alcoholic and could not manage our own life. Step two, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And step two, that God could and would if he was sought. Being convinced of what? Of these ABCs, we were at step three, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood him. And I think our book is being very kind here, that we decide to turn our will and life over to God like we're a God bigger than God. What choice do we really have at this point? Coming in, experiencing step one, there better be a step two for my solution. Step two is the solution to this whole thing. And all we do in step three is make a decision to get to the solution. What choice is there really left there? I mean, we're really at the jumping off place. There better be something to take me to this power because I'm screwed if I don't get it. It says, oh, many times in AA you'll hear these wordy, windy, long arguments on what it is to turn it over. What is step three all about? It go on for eons, man. Just, this is how I turn it over. Let go and let God. Turn it over. I want to turn tables over and hit the guy who said, let go and let God. How do you do this? What does this mean? You know, they would tell me your life's none of your business. I said, that's what you think. It's all my business. You know, how do you let go of this? How do you turn this to this power? Well, look what our book says. Just what do we mean by that? And just what do we do? Oh, okay. I can follow directions. Right to the book, right to directions. It's going to tell me how to do this and what they mean by turning it over. Very clear-cut, precise, exact directions. The first requirement in order to do this, there's a requirement, is that I be convinced that my life, run on self-will, can hardly be a success. My sponsor asked me this question. Are you convinced that your life, up until this point, has been a success when you running the show? And that was pretty easy to answer. Of course it wasn't. That's a yes or no answer, by the way. If the prospect starts doing this, well, I don't know, leave. On that basis, we're almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. What I'm about to read, see if this makes sense for where we are currently, if you experience any of this stuff currently. Most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show. Sounds like an AA business meeting so far, right? Is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the play is in his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Everyone, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, our actor may sometimes be quite virtuous. He may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. I can be so dishonest even when I'm trying to be kind, because why? I have self-seeking motives. I'll pat you on the back and tell you what a great guy you are, great person you are, because I have a motive behind it. That's dishonest. It's manipulation through kindness. Do I do any of that stuff? That's what they're talking about. What fuels all of this stuff? Why do I have to be there? Because I'm so attached to my external world to make me feel okay inside. I can never, ever stand the fact of you not liking me. I cannot live with that. I may be able to deal with that for a little while, but if my external world turns against me, my legs come out from under me. So therefore, I'm fueled by fear, and I have to be this actor and director and perform. this stage character. So everyone doesn't like me. Everyone has to worship me. That's bondage of self. Page 62. And now we get down to the core of what we're about, untreated. First paragraph, it says, selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. We're driven by 100 forms of fear. We're taken by fear. Okay? Self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity. And we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us, seemingly without provocation. But we invariably find that at some time in the past we have made decisions based on who? On me, which later placed me in a position to be hurt.
I don't think I come in and I'm the actor, like Peter says, and I think that, okay, I'm trying to do this, I'm trying to do that, but just let me get to where I have to be as far as the booze is concerned. And I'll try to go ahead and take care of everything. But I've got a motive here. I've got to get to my solution. Here, it talks about selfishness and self-centeredness. And I heard a man, a gentleman by the name of Bob O, out of Colorado, and he described it so well for me. And it's like I'm in a, you know, in the submarine you have these periscopes, you know, and it's like an oblong periscope, and I'm looking into it, and it's always looking right back at me. I'm the only one I'm seeing. And I'm walking around this planet like that all the time. Where's mine? There's a great statement of hope on this next paragraph. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. And the reason why that's a great statement of hope is because of if all my troubles were of my making, and the way I look at them, and the way I perceive them today, currently, no one out there has to change. No one out there has to change. All I have to do is follow a few simple rules to get free of that and be awake to that, to the truth in that statement, that my troubles are of my own making. That they arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Delusion. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of selfishness. We must, or it kills us. God makes that possible. That's why part of this solution, all of this solution, is going back a few pages where our constant thought is of others and how we may help meet their needs. It's not a selfish program.
We're looking to experience the death of self, daily dying a successful living. And what this work will do is little by slowly, we will experience the death of self. And when we do, what we are is then rocket into that fourth dimension and integrated with this power. There's a big difference of being driven by self and being free of self. And I've been on both sides of that, and I prefer being free of self, trust me.
Next sentence. And there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without his aid. That means one day at a time, I'm going to be falling short. So one day at a time, I must be seeking him. Many of us had moral or philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them, even though we would have liked to. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness, much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to, a must. We had to have God's help. So I have to have God's help. And for years, while in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm looking at that third step. And I don't know why, but for some strange reason in the back of my mind, I'm thinking I have to be cleaned up before I even show up for the third step. I've got it completely backwards. Peter just mentioned it. I have to die the death of self. And the only way I'm going to do it, or the only way that's ever worked for me, is 4 through 9. Peter mentioned something else before about how do you do that? How do I turn my life and my will over to the care of God? And the man that carried the message to me, I asked him the same question. And he just asked me, he says, do you know how to count? I says, well, all you have to do is learn how to count from 4 to 9. And take the actions against your will involved in that.
You know how you work step 3, by the way? Put pen to paper and start step 4. It says this is the how and why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. Why? It didn't work. Next, which means now, we decided to turn in this hereafter, in the drama of life, God was going to be our director. He is the principal. We are his agent. The principal has power. The agent represents the principal. I was sharing with someone yesterday. We've all heard of Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan is the principal. He hires an agent to go out and represent him. He represents Michael Jordan. God is the principle. We represent God. On page 68, in a couple of pages from here, it's going to say that God will demonstrate through us what he can do. That's a great amount of responsibility and power we're given that we certainly don't deserve. Mm-hmm. He's the principle. We're the agent. We represent God in all our affairs, even when we fall short. He's the director. He's running the show. It says, he is the father. We are his children. What does a father do for his children? Give them everything he can. Loves them, cares for them, nurtures them, doesn't he?
Disciplines them.
Teaches them. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arc to which we passed to freedom. So again, we're building this archway that we're going to pass through free man at last, our book says. And we're putting the stones in place. And we want God to be the director or the builder of this archway. I was a union guy and a blue-collar worker for many years. You don't want me building the archway because I know how to take shortcuts and it'll probably collapse in 2 weeks. I want God building this. Because lunchtime I would leave a cinder block hanging and going to lunch, I'll see you later. And God, there's no time with God. He'll make it perfect. We follow directions, we'll have this archway created by God, which we pass through, we're electrified, and we wake up and we get free on the other side. It says, when we sincerely took this such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. I work with the bottom of page 62 to page 63, third step promises, for a couple of months, and I've had wonderful experiences sitting with this stuff, these ideas. It says, when we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. Being all-powerful, he, God, provided what we needed. A promise and a warning. He will provide us what we need if we kept close to him and performed his work well. That'll happen. If we don't, it won't. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves. I like you to circle the word less and less. We're less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs, more and more. Key words here. Circle the words more and more. We became interested in what we can contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, this sounds like the opposite of the bedevilments on page 52. As we became conscious of God's presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. We didn't even start step 4 yet, and they're giving us these promises. That may manifest somewhere in 4 through 9, but they're there nonetheless. We wake up to these things whenever God sees fit, but they're there. It says, we are now at step 3. Many of us said to our Maker as we understood him, and they give us our third step prayer. One of the great things my boat sponsors did for me was this. I read this prayer, and a lot of fancy language in this third step prayer. First time I looked at it, I really wasn't sure what it meant. What my sponsor had me do is just a wonderful assignment. The idea was to have an experience with this book, and this book become personal to me. Everything in this book personal to me, so I have an experience with it. And what he allowed me to do was write out this third step prayer word for word. And underneath it, write out my interpretation of what this third step prayer meant to me. And I wrote it out in my own language. When it says, God, I offer myself to thee, what does that mean? What does that mean to me? And I would write it out line by line. And little by slowly, I created my interpretation of this third step prayer, and suddenly this third step prayer became my prayer. There was a connection. It bridged the gap, if you will. Same thing with the seventh step prayer in our book. I did the same thing with that. It became personal to me, and I didn't even realize it, but I was having an experience because there's some very powerful words in this third step prayer.
So I think for anyone that would like to or is able to, we could all kneel down and say this prayer.
Shift. You want to lead with the mic?
Yeah. I'll lead and we'll follow. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do that well always.
Well,
so the first time I was given and said that prayer in this process, the man that carried the message to me approached me, and we held hands together and did this. And he says, you know, your life's none of your business anymore, period.
I got to share with you, I was watching everyone do this third step prayer. You guys are a lot different from New Yorkers because everyone had their eyes closed and did this prayer. In New York, it's kind of like this. When yeah, looking over your back just in case. That was pretty neat. Now that we did the third step prayer, what does our book says? It tells us we thought well before taking the step, making sure we were ready. That we could last abandon ourselves utterly to him. We did the third step prayer. Sometimes you'll hear in AA, we'll work the first three steps. Get a good third step. Be careful of your fourth step. It may get you drunk. You're not ready for your fourth step. A lot of this contemporary information by misinformed people, and people die off of that. But we've done our third step prayer, and what does our book say? Bottom of page 63, it says next, which means next. Now, how do I work my third step? I pick up a pen and paper, and I start my fourth step. It says, next, we launch out in a course of vigorous action. We do things with vigor. We go to the gymnasium or a health club, and we do a vigorous workout. We don't smoke a cigar like I would on a bench and hang out and expect to get results. We work, and that's what they're telling us here. The first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us had never attempted. Though our decision was vital and crucial, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which have been blocking us. Great promise. So if I do this work, this decision is long-lasting. It isn't a temporary thing.
See, again, the third step is only a decision, followed immediately by next we launch. But the third step is still a decision. My friend Joey, he talks about, you know, like the three frogs on a log. The three frogs on a log, and one of them decides to jump off. How many frogs you got on the log? We have some smart people here. There's still three because he only made the decision. He didn't take any action and launch and jump.
So by doing steps 4 through 9, this decision has a permanent effect. If we don't do 4 through 9, the the decision as long as lasting as the third step prayer took to say, probably. And what we're going to do is face and be rid of the things in us which are blocking us from this power. We're going to be rid of the things, all the manifestations of self, which are blocking us from this power. And that's where house cleaning comes in. Because in step four, which we're about to talk about, it has nothing to do with what you did to me, even though you may have done something to me that was harmful. It's about me taking a look at my part in every situation. And we're going to be talking about resentments, the number one offender that kills alcoholics, fears, sex inventory principles and institutions. It talks about going back through our lives. Step four does not start with our first drink up until where we are currently. It's about us going back as far as we can remember, because the isms were there before we picked up a drink. Now, I've had things happen to me, and I've heard many people share these things over the years. We're going to be looking at step four about where was my part? What role did I play in this? Where was I at fault? Well, some of us had things happen to us as little children that weren't very pleasant. Being violated and things like that. And I showed up to my sponsor and I told him, hey, I didn't do anything wrong. I was a little boy. I was about 8 years old. Where am I at fault in this? This book is a lie. They made a mistake. And I was a little bit angry about it. And he had a similar thing happen to him. This was with my first sponsor. And he asked me this question, how long have you been hating this person for? And I thought about it, and I can feel the blood rising feeling a lot of ugly feelings about this man. And I says, I still do hate him. And if I'm old enough now and I'm physically fit enough to do some harm to him, and I would like to maybe one day do this. And he says, that's what you need to be rid of, just that. Because you've been harboring this for so long, and that is one of the any lens. You don't have to love the person. You don't have to have a relationship with them. You just need to let go of the hate. Because that will keep me blocked. That will be that thing, that wedge that is still between me and this power. And that was certainly rubber hitting the road for me. I can tell you this, because I'm sure there are a bunch of us who've had similar experiences like that in this room this morning, by this afternoon. I experienced a great freedom. Because I thought it was something I was foolish to try to get rid of. I did not want to get rid of. And I didn't think I was going to be able to get rid of. But by working through this stuff and lots of disciplines, I got to, and some outside help, I got to a place of being free of that. No longer feeling like I caused any of that stuff. No longer believing I was dirty because of it. I got completely free of that. And I've been in this gentleman's company a couple of times. And I was placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. Thank God, because if I wasn't, I don't know what my reaction would be to him now as an adult male. But that was God doing for me what I can never do for myself. If I was sick and untreated, I may be in jail for doing harm to him today. But God knows what I need and gives me what I need. So I can promise you that we can get free of a lot of things, probably everything in Alcoholics Anonymous, if we work at it. I'll be taken there. And I look in the mirror today with dignity, no longer shame. And I did for many, many years. I felt horrific on the inside. That's great news, I think, to us. See, it's always about the drink, but it's also about a lot of other things that we need to be free of. Because the drink now is removed. We're in step four. It was separated from alcohol. Now we have alcoholism. And all the things that accompany it. It's a magnet to trouble. It's a magnet to manifestations of self. It's just a magnet. And it just breeds more resentment, more fear, more frustration, more anger, and we need to do something about it. And there are little dramas in life that we've all experienced that we're harboring. And God forbid we should tell someone else, right? Ego won't allow it. And I found when I shared this stuff the first time, I was waiting for the whole AA room to walk out the door, and I can't tell you how many people came up to me afterwards and had very similar experiences. I knew, once again, I was not alone. We've all had our little behind-the-scenes things that no one needs to know about. But step four demands we put this stuff down in order to be free.
Therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four, a business which takes no personal. No regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding, searching, and a fact-facing. Feel it. All we're doing is facing facts and putting them on paper. And we go into this with prayer. It is an effort to discover the truth about the stock in trade. One object is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods, as Peter was sharing, to get rid of them promptly and without regret. If the owner of the business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values. What is it worth? We did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup, which caused our failure. Being convinced that self, manifested in various ways, was what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations. I have to put this on paper in black and white and take a look at it. There's something that happens when I put pen to the paper that doesn't happen between my two ears when I'm trying to think about it. And I've listened in Alcoholics Anonymous when we're on fourth steps and all they're talking about, oh, I've taken it in my head. I've taken my head. I take my inventory in my head for 20 years back and forth in and out of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm doing that with a sick mind. All I'm doing is beating myself up. So we'll let Peter start off with Peter's writing. Okay. Nice eraser. Yeah, Peter.
Four-column inventory. Resentment. Person we're angry with. Cause is the reason we're angry with this person. And we can include self and God in that column. We also can write four-column inventory or answer questions with fear, which we'll get to later. The person I'm angry with. The cause, the reason why. Resentment, my boss, cause, didn't pay me overtime money. Resentment, my wife, cause, burned dinner again. Okay. Effects, there's seven areas of life they talk about. Personal relationships, how I think this relationship ought to look like. My self-esteem, how I see or feel about myself. My security, what I need to be okay. My ambition, my goals, my aspirations, my sex relations, and not only sex, but my idea of how a man ought to be in a relationship, a role of a man, and what I think a role of a woman ought to be. Pride, how I think others see me. Pocketbook, money. The person, self, or God that we're angry with, the reason why. We list either all or some of the areas of self that are affected. And where I'm at fault. And this is where rubber hits the road. Because no one wants to look at self in here. These are the manifestations of self in column four. Selfishness, self-centeredness, anger, lust, greed, frustration, all of it. This is where I show up, right in here. And that's the stuff in column four that has to be removed. If I remove what's in column four, none of this other stuff is going on. Ideally, if I have no column four, I'm free, aren't I? Because none of these other areas are affected. There's no cause to be angry with someone, and none of these areas of my life are affected because I don't have self running the show. Four column inventory is the most simplest set of instructions to follow, and most of us balk at it. If you're sponsoring someone and you want to lose them, get them to step four ASAP. You know that nudge prospect who tells you every single thing that's going on? Get him to step four. He'll find somebody else. Or they'll get to the first three columns and get to four, and they'll balk again. And what I did with this was I listed people. It says we went back through our lives before the first drunk. And I start writing people in the first column. And my sponsor instructed me, do not deny the Spirit. Ask God for the power to be searching, fearless, and moral, and to see truth. And I start writing names. Mom, dad, grandparents, cousins, aunts. And I just start writing names, and the names are just flowing off the pen. That's a spiritual thing, by the way, when you go to God to do that, and you find your pen just moving, and names keep coming. Do not deny the Spirit, because what will happen is, and it gets, guys I sponsor happens to me all the time, they ask me the same question. Well, I came across this guy's name, I don't have a resentment with, I don't have to put it down, right? And I tell them, wrong, put it down. We don't deny the Spirit. Whatever names come to us, we keep writing in this column.
See, because when we'll put down a name, and then I shouldn't be angry at that person after all this person's done for me. But that's the. But I put what Peter said. It came to me in prayer. This was revealed to me. Write the name down. It's a spiritual exercise.
I was writing names here, and lots of names came to me that I said, well, why are these names on this list? Why are these names coming to me? Someone from the third grade in grade school, someone in high school that I didn't make sense. It just didn't make sense to me. And I asked my sponsor that question. He says, don't deny the Spirit, keep writing. There were certain people that came to me that I didn't know their name, but I wrote out a little description of what they were. Guess what? When I finished the first column, because we work in columns. Sometimes if we go across with one inventory after another, we kind of lose what we're going back to. It gets very confusing that way. So we list all the names. Just go right down the list. The names I wasn't sure about, or the ones I had to write a little description of who these people were, guess what? When I got to the second column here, the cause, stuff came to me. Now the other thing, some of it may be really trivial. You know, the big kid in the back of the class tripped me when I walked into class. Sounds really trivial, and it is. But why is that still with me when I'm writing inventory 20, 30 years later? Maybe when I walk into a room full of people now, I'm waiting to get attacked. I'm feeling really self-centered. Everyone's looking at me. I still feel a little bit foolish about walking into a room full of people because maybe that little thing that I thought was so trivial wasn't. So we don't question. We just follow instructions. And then I get to the third column, and I complete my fourth column. That person is done. What I found, I would write, say, mom, and when I got to the second column, I would have maybe 5, 10, 15 different reasons. I would get to dad and have a whole bunch. You know, don't be cheap on paper. There's plenty around. Put a couple of inventories on a sheet of paper and then move. I've gotten inventories, man, on like one sheet of paper. It was, you know, I couldn't even read what the guy wrote, nor could he. We get to sex inventory. What I had done to me was I would write sex inventory, and this was something that no one was going to see. And I remember reading my sex inventory to my sponsor, and it was all little squiggly writing because I couldn't read it. And he realized how much shame I had still attached to my sexual past and my role of what I thought a man ought to be and a woman ought to be. But when I had to write down, you know, resentment towards an old employer about what he did to me, it was in these. So, but this is our four-column inventory. It's really, really simple. We follow directions and we get guidance from a sponsor, but we must pray in order to write, to be searching, fearless, and moral, and to see truth. Because my experience was this. When I didn't write the first time through this work, I would do a lot of other things before I did this or minimize and justify myself right out of this work. So we seek counsel with a sponsor and we go to God first, and the pen will move. Column four is the column where rubber hits the road, in my experience has been, and that's where we get free.
Page 66. After we see this in the first couple of columns, and in the third column, we're going to experience some stuff. Page 66 says, it is plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. One of the favorite songs that I had was by Billy Joel, An Angry Young Man. I love that song. I was driving around and I identified so much with that song. To the precise extent that we permit these, it provides it. Do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? I can't walk around with that. I don't handle. I'm different than other people. I can't handle resentment like a normal person can. Resentment will take me back. But with the alcoholic, whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. We found that it is fatal. For when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns, and we drink again. And with us, to drink is to die. If we were to live, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm was not for us. They may be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for alcoholics, these things are poison. So we turn back to this list, for it, the list, held the key to the future. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. We began to see the world and its people really dominated us. The world and the people really dominated us. In that state, the power that the world and the people have over us to take space in my mind. In that state, the wrongdoing of others, in that state of mind, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, had power to actually kill. How could I escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? We could not wish them away any more than alcohol. This was our cause. We realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Though we did not like their symptoms, all the stuff that you write down in column two, and the way they disturbed us, all those parts of me in column three, my security, my self-esteem, my pride, they, like ourselves, were sick too. We asked God to show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that I would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, this is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him?
That's our anger prayer.
And I found that very helpful to write that prayer out and say that prayer before I got into each individual, each person in that resentment inventory, in that fourth column. We avoid retaliation or argument. It's a great spiritual principle. My friend Don shared with me, and I found it added to be true. If I raise my voice, I'm wrong. We wouldn't treat sick people that way. If we do, we destroy our chance of being helpful. We cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God will show us how to take a kindly, tolerant view of each and every one.
If we realize that other people are spiritually sick, how could I judge and take things personally? If they're walking around blocked from the sunlight of the Spirit, that's all they're capable of doing, even though it may be harmful, why would I take anything personally? If I walk into an AA meeting, for example, and there's a new recruit there, just coming off a drunk, and is restless, irritable, and discontented, and when I go to introduce myself, he tells me where I can take my handshake. Would I take that personally? Of course not. I realize where they're coming from. They're spiritually sick. Shouldn't I apply that same principle out there? When people do things that aren't kind, why would I take things personally and harbor resentment and walk away like they did this to me, Pete Marinelli, when they're blocked from the sunlight of the Spirit? When I find myself practicing not taking things personally, I get moved to a place of no longer judging others, like I'm better than you because maybe I operate a little bit better in certain areas. That's a great freedom to experience. It says, referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we're on page 67. We resolutely look for our own mistakes. This is column 4. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Though a situation had not been entirely our fault, we tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. Where were we to blame? The inventory was ours, not the other man's. My tendency before I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous and did this work was, it was you did this to me, and you were at fault, and I was right. I was right, and you were wrong, and my book eliminates that. It says, we placed them before us in black and white, pen to paper. We admitted our wrongs honestly, and we're willing to set these matters straight. Now we get into talking about fear. Tom?
Okay. I just wanted to share a little bit more about this fourth column real fast. Before I got into the fourth column on each person, what showed up in my first inventory was delusion. And it's a form of dishonesty. And the delusion was, if I looked at what I was angry at that person, and I looked at myself, because this is my inventory, not theirs, and I have to ask myself some questions. Haven't I done what I'm angry at that person for? Haven't I done the same thing to him, or perhaps to another person? So if that person may be spiritually sick, the way I look at it and what I term it as, this person is experiencing a bump in the road being spiritually sick, just like I have. So who am I to judge him when I've experienced the same thing in the past? We all have our bumps in the road.
It's...